Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to The Accelerator with Michael Conniff. That's me. We're a podcast that goes out to people interested in startups and even roll-ups and everything to do with being an entrepreneur. We're a companion podcast to The Angel, which is more on the money side of things. Today, we are joined by an extremely distinguished businessman, entrepreneur, somebody who really has done a lot to help people. Dave Liniger is former top executive, one of the top executives, at least at RealMax. Did I say that right? No, I got that wrong. RE/MAX, excuse me, RE/MAX. And Dave has written a book called The Perfect 10. Is it okay if I call it a self-help book for entrepreneurs, Dave?
Yes, that would be appropriate.
Okay, so tell us first of all, tell us about, sort of in a nutshell, your career with RE/MAX, which grew into one of the, you know, the great real estate empires in the world. How did that come about, and what was your role in that growth?
Well, I was in the United States Air Force for several years. Part of my enlistment, when I was stateside, I started buying and fixing up houses. And eventually led me to get a real estate license, not to ever sell real estate, but to save the commission on my deals. As I got out of the service, I realized I was going full time into real estate investing. I might as well get a broker's license and start my own company. I moved from Scottsdale to Denver in 1971, did a residency for 6 months to get my broker's license. And then I founded RE/MAX in January of 73. Since that period of time, it was a very hard start, controversial. Industry did not like my ideas, but we have now grown to being a very recognized kind of a icon of the industry. We have offices in, 9,000 offices, 110 countries. Wow. And 150,000 agents.
And what was, you said it was a hard start. What made it hard? And what was the new wrinkle that RE/MAX was bringing to the business?
At the time that I started, real estate agents shared their commission with the owner of the office. And if it was a listing, the owner kept half, the agent kept half. If it was a buyer, the company kept half, the agent kept half. So it was a 50-50 split around that. What we looked at was, why not take experienced realtors, no beginners or part-timers, and operate like a co-op, a group of doctors, lawyers, architects, dentists, share office space, share the overhead costs, pay our own personal expenses, and keep 100% of our fees for ourselves. Quite controversial, because if it worked, the agents were keeping 85-15 instead of 50-50. So the powers to be, the big successful companies, they all fought the concept, said it wouldn't work, it would never happen. They did everything they could to drive us out of business. They didn't have to work too hard. I was making enough mistakes. I probably could have done it by myself. But as it is, you learn to be a street fighter. I didn't have a college education. Mm-hmm. And so I supplemented my weaknesses. First hire I made was to hire an administrative vice president. I would be the recruiter, the sales manager, the trainer, and the administrative vice president would run the company, find the office space, hire secretaries, bookkeepers, set up legal contracts, furnish and organize the businesses, that type of thing. And the 28th person I interviewed was a superstar. She had just moved to Denver. She was a trailing spouse. Her husband was going to be MADNF manager of a chain of stores. And so she was looking for a new challenge. She was confident. She was very smart. She had an excellent resume, lots of experience in management and marketing. And it was just a home run. So I lied to her and told her that I was going to build the largest real estate company in, history of the world. If she'd help me do it, she could run it.
And what was her name?
Her name was Gail Main. And that started us off on an interesting journey. We were partners basically for the first 10 years. And after that, we became married. And so
okay.
my best friend has been my partner for 50 years and my wife for 40 years. So it worked out extremely well.
And the important thing is you're still married. That's great. And I want to point out that you're coming to us from your rather expansive ranch in Colorado. So all that hard work paid off, to say the least. I'm curious about the shifting of the business model. How did you, if you're giving all of that or most of that income to the realtor, how does RE/MAX make money? How did you make money?
Originally, we had a management fee that was paid to the company every month for overseeing and doing the business. Eventually, we kind of switched to a 95-5 model, 95% to the agent, 4% to the broker that owned the office, and 1% to headquarters, plus our regular fees. So it became financially lucrative for all three parties to the arrangement, and it has worked out extremely well for everybody.
So what made you realize that you had to change the business model to do RE/MAX?
Well, the business model as it was a high turnover business. There are no barriers to entry for an agent to get a license. In some places, it's merely a check and maybe a test in a 30-hour course. So agents come in, they think it's going to be a nice, easy job. Drive around in a nice car, entertain people, buy lunches and dinners, and make big commissions. The problem you get into is there are no salaries or advances in the real estate business. So in essence, you're in business for yourself, but by yourself. And you have to find out how to make a commission. And often you don't make one in the first 6 months. And that's pretty damning. It's Consumer Federation just put out a big study a couple of weeks ago. 50% of the realtors in the United States have not closed the transaction in over 12 months.
Wow. That's not surprising, really, because there's so many. The market goes up and down. It's variable by region, city, town, all sorts of things. Well, let me ask you about the Perfect 10. So I know you've got other business interests. There's lots of things you could do. Why stop and why write this book?
Well, a lot of people helped me along the way. I didn't have a formal education. I blew my opportunity for that. I realized I wasn't mature enough to go to college. The military gave me 6 or 7 years to grow up and become a real human being instead of a teenage boy. So I learned a lot from it. A lot of people helped me on the way. When I first started the company, it was dreadful. I made all the mistakes you could, but I didn't want to fail. So I sat down, swallowed my pride, and I talked to my managers. I had 8 of them. They were all 20 years older than me. And I said, look, what'd you like best about the company you left? What did you dislike the most? What do you like most about RE/MAX? What do you dislike the most? What do you like most about me? What do you dislike the most? Can you teach me, with your maturity and your success and my idealistic idea of I can build this empire, can you train me to be the leader you want me to be? And they did. They flat out did. They said some things, they hurt, but I realized, yeah, I'm making those mistakes. Okay, I'm gonna fix it up. So every meeting, I wrote them down. I listened to it with an open mind instead of being angry and said, okay, if everybody else sees the problem and I don't, you must be right and I'm wrong. So let's fix it.
So I kept an open. And you started in 73. How old were you when you started the company?
27.
27. Okay, so you're a young guy, you're in your 20s, but it strikes me that you had turned listening into an art. So, and I think that, you know, asking people how can I do better? What am I doing well? What am I doing wrong? It's like, so, isn't that so obvious? But it's, but people, I don't think it's part of basic management training, is it?
But it should be.
Sure.
You know, in the military, for generations, it was a command down concept. The general said jump, and the private had to say hi on the way up. When they started creating the special forces, whether it's SEAL teams, Delta, Rangers, whatever it might be, it's a different attitude. Usually it's a smaller team, 8 to 10 people, usually have an officer involved. Almost everybody else has got more time, so they're mostly NCOs. There's no, nothing sacred about the officer. If you're
this
in the field.
An elite team, right? An elite team in the military, like Delta Force, for example.
Sure.
So this is not the whole military, but in an elite team, you're saying, you know, hierarchy kind of doesn't disappear, but it has a different meaning.
Yeah, and the SEAL team leads from the front. The generals and most of the military lead from the rear. They're too valuable to get injured or hurt. And so you're right with your leader. And so when you design a concept for a job that you're going to accomplish, all 8 or 10 people are equal. There's no yes, sir, no, sir. There's no saluting. By the way, in the field, there's never saluting because the officer is the first one the sniper takes out.
And so, and were you yourself in Delta Force?
No, I was not.
Okay, so this is kind of, again, by observation and listening and keeping your ears open.
And so everybody puts the plan together. They rehearse together. They actually do the mission together. And when they're done, they download and reassess what went right, what went wrong. And so it might be a lowly private that looks at the lieutenant and says, "Lieutenant, we cleared the room. You were supposed to go left. What you did was you went to the right, right underneath my gun sights. And if I'd been less sharp, I might have shot you."
Uh-huh.
And that the lieutenant says, "I knew when I went right, I should have gone left. It was my bad, my mistake. Thanks for calling me out on it. I'll work on it." And so,
now how is this represented, this kind of concept, these concepts represented in your book, The Perfect 10?
We talk about a servant leader. We talk about a democratic leader where you take the ideas from everyone. And by the way, RE/MAX is an extraordinarily successful company. Every single great idea in our company has come from the field. The mm-hmm. foot soldiers in the trenches that are out there talking to people day in and day out. Now, they bring in some wacky ideas. And so you don't have to take every idea that comes. But just be open-minded enough to say, when you have 140,000 people, there's a lot of mind power out there, and you can make changes. You can't just keep doing yesterday's business with yesterday's methods today and expect to be in business tomorrow.
You know, it's interesting. I've seen something similar to this. I actually just had a Zoom before this podcast with a couple of entrepreneurs who had, you know, a modest exit and are now, you know, cooking up their next thing. And part of it is like, I'm thinking to myself, well, why are they talking to me? They know I'm not going to give them money. I don't know enough about what their space. But basically they were doing a pretty good job of listening and, you know, indirectly tapping into my network, of course, but I think that, and I had another situation where two entrepreneurs who had worked together, one was a CTO, one was a CEO, have a new technology, and basically they're telling people about it, select people, and they're listening, right? They're listening to what the feedback is. So it sounds to me that the one thing that really enabled you to be tremendously successful was your willingness to listen and not just, and let me put it this way, not just to listen, but to hear.
You know, I mentor a lot of people, and they all nod their heads and say yes while I'm speaking and answering their questions. But you know that only 3 or 4 out of 100 are going to do something with it.
Why is that? Because why don't more? What holds people back?
People don't like to change. They can agree with you. They need to change, but they'll listen. They'll say that's entertaining. Hey, that's a good idea, but they won't implement it. My most successful mentees have been the ones that were really thirsty for the knowledge, took notes, would call me back up 4 or 5 days later and say, can I have 5 minutes of your time? I did this and this and this like you recommended, and this is where I'm at. What else would you tell me to do? And so you know they're executing.
Excuse me for interrupting, but you know, I always take notes, except during podcasts, because I'm trying to concentrate on the guests. But it's such a simple thing, and it enables you. And by the way, these new note takers, these new AI note takers, I honestly, Dave, I've been kind of amazed at how much I miss, even though I take notes, and even though I was a trained reporter, journalist, right? I'm supposed to know how to do this. How much that I missed. And that how much there is really to follow up upon as you go forward. So I also want to get at what are some of the most important precepts that represent the perfect 10. Tell me why the perfect 10, why that name, why that title?
The perfect 10 is the concept that in platform diving, in gymnastics, in horse
skating.
Ice skating, they have judges, and you do your performance. At the end of the performance, you're looking desperately to the judges who are going to write on their cards 7, 6, 5, hoping not only will I get a 10, but will I get a 10 on all 7 judges' cards.
Except for the Russian judge, of course, who's always going to be lower, but continue. Yeah,
especially if you're American.
Yeah.
So anyway, that started the genesis, but have you heard of Net Promoter Score as a business way of judging customer satisfaction?
I have not. What is that?
So NPS is a very simple set of 1 or 2 questions that you can ask a customer. For instance, you can ask them to rank how likely it is would you recommend our business to a relative or a friend? And then they rank them, 1 being worst, and 10 being best.
Yeah, I think we've all filled out a lot of those online, right? Where you're asked for feedback. Yeah.
So what you do is you take all the 9s and 10s, and those are promoters, and you take the 6s, 7s, and 8s and ignore them. They don't care. And you take the 1 through 5s, and they're detractors. You get your total score, and you take your promoters less your detractors, and that's your score. So in 2017, one of the stats we looked at was United Airlines got a 2, and Southwest Airlines,
which is terrible.
And Southwest got a 66.
Wow.
Now, they have the same planes, same Boeings, same destinations, same discount prices, and yet totally different satisfactions. Well, maybe United's flight attendants have all been around with seniority. They knew what it was fun to fly 30 years ago. And first class was first class. And now everything's a cattle car. They're overburdened. There's burnout and they're tired. And they're just waiting to get that retirement check. Southwest was a much younger company, younger employees, happy-go-lucky kids that were, you know, just flying for the first 5 or 10 years. They were excited about their job. They laughed and joked with the audience. The pilot makes a bad landing. They want him to grab the mic and say, well, welcome here. Kangaroo made it again. And everybody laughs.
Yeah, they use so, it's a very intentional use of humor and comedy to kind of create community and to be personable. And it really makes them human beings, doesn't it?
Yeah. So to get to the point, Remax did the Net Promoter Score. We knew every agent. Every office in the United States and Canada, we sent out a letter from me on an email that said, nobody will see these. and your name, except for one person. Me, I'm the founder of the company. And I will not divulge who tells me anything. But we will develop a scorecard for each company, each office, et cetera. Open rate was fabulous. I'm very popular in the company. I've been speaking to them for 55 years. I'm one of them. We got an overall score of 72.
Wow.
So that's the same as Google, Amazon, Apple, et cetera. That's just about the highest you can get up to. So we looked at the individual offices. We had 200 offices that had the responses that were a perfect 10. Mm. 200 out of 4,000. And that's offices like Anchorage. We have a woman up there that's just a fabulous manager. Mm. And then the second question you can ask, why? And about half the time, they'll tell you why. And so if you give it a 10, why? I've got the best manager in the world. She cares about me and my family. Every time I have a problem, I can go to her, and she's got a smile on her face and said, we can work this out. So you go through those answers. We had 200 that got an actual minus 100, the worst you could get. Hmm. And that's 200 out of 4,000 offices. And we looked at their comments, and it was, my broker's a jerk. He doesn't do a thing for me. I had a problem with an appraisal, and he said, I don't have time to help you. Do it yourself. And so it really comes down to outstanding leadership at the top, caring for the people that are there.
Were you able to fix the problems at the bottom?
Yeah. We gave him a report card, and we told him these are your deficiencies, and if you can't get up into the mainstream, we're not going to renew your franchise.
Okay, so there was a little carrot and stick. There was some stick in there.
Oh, a lot of stick and carrot.
Yeah.
And so I can't want to make somebody more successful than what they would have made themselves. And so if we can do the study and we can say, our analysis says, this is what's going wrong. This is what you need to do to fix it. If they don't fix it, then it's too bad. I can't fix it for them.
What do you think is the one or two lessons that you would like to people who read your book to take away from? And I know that you're a believer in Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, which I still think is the, not just me, but is regarded as the classic of the self-help field. And sometimes I feel like everybody is just riffing on Napoleon Hill from the 1920s, literally. Andrew Carnegie sent him out to interview the most successful people in America. And he came back with, you know, you need purpose, you need a plan, you need goals, you need deadlines. So what do you see in addition to those sort of obvious things and well-known things? What is kind of the secret sauce in what you're telling people in this book?
In this book, we've got 10 sections with 10 great ideas in each one. One section's on leadership. One's on scalability and making your company bigger. One's on team building. One's on personal development. And so I've tried to take the lessons that I've learned, not only from my experiences, but we had researchers that helped us. And we looked at about 75% of the book is based on Amazon, Google, Apple, the other thought leaders of the last two or three generations to say, this is how these people took a simple concept and made it incredibly successful for everybody. So, for instance, I've got a chapter on Sir Ernest Shackleton. Shackleton was an Arctic explorer.
Yep.
He tried to cross the South Pole, and in the process, they got iced in. Ice flow collapsed around them. They were going to live on the ship until the ice melted, but the ice started crushing it, and they realized the ship was going to sink. So he took them out on the lifeboats, put the lifeboats on the ice floe, took all the food and everything they could carry with them, and got away from the ship, and it sank. They were marooned on the ice for 22 months. There was no radios, no telegraphs, no newspapers, and it was in dark half the year. And He saved every one of his men. He finally sailed off in one of the lifeboats with a sail and two or three other explorers. And they went 700 miles in rough seas to a whaling station and got a boat back and saved them. All the men wrote in their journals that Shackleton was the finest leader they had ever followed in their life. And in his journal, he talked about he wanted to kill half of them, and he was fed up with them. But the thing that was amazing was he was such a kind leader. He cared about them individually. He met with every one of them every day for the 22 months. He didn't let them have cliques. They had to change the tents, two and three people to a tent. And after a week, they had to be with somebody else in another tent. It was a group effort to survive. They survived happy. They didn't lose weight. They managed to live off of seals and fish sometimes. But he was a brilliant leader. And the thing's interesting, the thing's most interesting to me, he had, I think, six or seven sisters. Mm-hmm. And he grew up with no boyfriends. And so he grew up around girls. And as you know, today, people acknowledge that women often are better leaders and better managers than men. They mm-hmm. have a more of a consensus-building feel. They don't like altercation. Most of them do not just try to be command and control. They try to do things more democratically. What's your idea? What's your idea? A lot of those things are incredibly important in today's management and leadership style. The command and control is gone forever.
Yeah, it's a different world, but it's interesting from the Arctic tundra to Remax, finding the threads there. So let's, you know, every day it seems like I talk to entrepreneurs who are struggling. It's a struggle, right? You said how hard it was when you began. And I'm as a mentor with mentees, you're probably hearing people are telling you things aren't working out, that they're having problems and whatnot. What's the most important thing to say to an entrepreneur at what I would call the moment of truth, when it wouldn't necessarily be easy to give it up, but they're certainly thinking about it, right? Because they're like, it's so much trouble. So what is the thing they need to think about right at that moment?
It's very simple. Why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. Why are you abusing yourself? Why are you getting killed? Why are you taking all the lumps? What is it that makes you go? And what that comes down to is, what were you doing it for? Why were you doing it? What was your mission? My mission in Remax had nothing in it written about mission, goals, vision, anything. It was, I wanted to make life better for top producers, because there's so many beginners and part-timers and losers in my business, and the overhead is wasted on trying to make 1 out of 10 successful and watching 9 out of 10 fail. And so my idea was, why not do this co-op only with good, successful people you were proud to be working with, and us keep the majority of the money and have the lifestyle we wanted. And so when your passion is that, there's a reason for what I'm doing this, and it's not chasing the almighty buck, you can't quit. That's your life. That's the dream you had. My dream wasn't to make millions. I certainly did, but you can get anything in the world you want as long as you help enough other people get what they want. And so I think that just comes to the stick-to-itiveness, the grit, the ambition that I will not fail. I will not quit.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really well said. I want to remind everybody, this is The Accelerator with Michael Conniff. We're the companion podcast to The Angel. Make sure to sign up for our Substack email newsletter, which delivers all podcasts right to your email box. We're also up on Spotify and YouTube with audio and video, and then on all the major podcast platforms, Audible, Amazon, Apple, and others that don't just begin with the letter A. Our guest today is It's really been a privilege. The founder of RE/MAX, Dave Liniger, he has written a new book. It's out, right, Dave? The Perfect 10. Is it out? Yeah. And can you buy it now?
The official publication date is March the 24th or 26th.
Coming up soon in a couple weeks. But I want to say, like, I've read big portions of this book. I've read a lot of self-help books, and I think this is really one of the best ones I've read, in part because you kind of incorporate a lot of other ideas in other books, just as you were a great listener as a CEO. So we want to thank you so much for being with us, and wish you best of luck.
Thank you, Michael.
With that was the book fun. In the snows of Colorado. And thank you all out there. As we like to say, we'll be back with another podcast before you know it.